Today is May 22nd, 2009. This is Conduit. Speaker is Howard Taylor for the main address.
All right, welcome to the main address. There's several other events going on right now that are probably every bit as popular. My name is Howard Taylor, and I will be your host. We're going to talk about the relationship between raw ability, hard work, and artistic excellence. And before I begin, I need to define artistic excellence as something different than artistic success. What I currently enjoy as a full-time cartoonist is known as artistic success. That is not the same as excellence. Excellence is something that I'm still pursuing. It remains elusive. Is that the space bar? Okay. Did I hit that twice? Feels like I hit that twice. Where's the backspace button? Is it backspace? Okay, nope, that is supposed to be the next slide. Who am I? Here's my CV. 41, married, 4 children, full-time independent cartoonist, Bachelor of Arts, but I studied music, not cartooning. Previous experience as a record producer, tech support weenie, marketing guy, it's all over the map. 9 years experience now cartooning. I started drawing Schlock Mercenary in March of 2000. I started posting it on the web June 12th of 2000, and it's been running every day without fail since then. And in fact, I am drawn through March 12th right now, matter of fact, well past March 12th. So I'm pretty much guaranteed, knock on wood, wait, that's brushed aluminum, pretty much guaranteed 9 years of uninterrupted updates. You can Google me, I'm e-famous. I want to tell you some left-handed compliments, okay? Did you get a haircut? You look thinner. Hey, you clean up pretty nice. Gorgeous photos. You must have a nice camera. Okay, you've heard this one, haven't you? Oh, I hate that one. And finally, did you draw that? You are so talented.
Isn't this offensive to left-hand people?
Okay, it may be, but left-hand is the sinister, so we're allowed to make it be evil. Saying you must have an expensive camera is like telling a famous author she must be using a really fancy typewriter. My friend Drew said that he was ranting about painting and photography one day down at Dragon Feet. If it's not the camera... If somebody takes good pictures and not the camera, what could it be? Is it innate talent? Is it a good eye, whatever a good eye might be? Expensive lighting? I mean, certainly lighting enters into a good picture. Photogenic subject matter. Oh, you are a good photographer because you're taking pictures of pretty things. Or could it possibly be 10 years of taking pictures, reviewing those pictures with a critical eye, and then striving to take better pictures? That is Schlock, drawn in March of 2000. Howard Taylor, age 31. And you look at that, 31, you think, oh man, somebody spelled 13 wrong. No, I was 31 years old when I drew that picture. And you know what? Nobody looks at that picture and says, you are so talented. They look at that picture and they say, dude, don't quit your day job. You know what? 4 years after that, 4 years and 6 months after that, I quit my day job. Schlock, drawn in July of 2007. Now I hear, you are so talented. I wish I could draw like that. I mean, seriously, people wish that they could be talented enough to draw like the guy who started out drawing like that when he was wishing he was talented enough to draw like that. It's not about talent. But let's talk about this a little further. I don't draw this way because of talent. I draw this way because of 9 years of practice. If you really wish you could draw like this, the Wish-O-Matic genie is going to force you to draw something every day for a long, long time. Because that's how this wish comes true. Are you discouraged yet? Because, I mean, you all want to go on and do great things. I gave this lecture at a university Utah Valley University. I gave this lecture at a place that wants to be a university so bad that they changed their name and their curriculum. I love UVU. I've got good friends there on the faculty and the grounds crew. sorry, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. All right, I just told you this is going to take longer than you thought it was. In reality, it's probably going to take you even longer than that. Okay, most people, when they look at something they want to do, they look at it and they think, you know what? I bet I could do that in 4 years. I bet I could go to college and learn to do that. And in reality, that's a good start, but it usually takes longer than that. Now I'm going to get into some science. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about motivation. And for this, we are going to use a study that was done a few years back on some New York State public schools students. These are grade school kids. I think they were they fifth graders? I don't remember how old they were, but I think they were fifth graders. But they were given IQ tests, and then they were praised for the results, regardless of the results. Kid shows up with an IQ of 80, he was told, he was praised. But the praise came in two categories. One group was told, you must be smart at this. And the other group was told, you must have worked hard at this. That was the only distinction. Whether they were whether they actually did well on the test or not had no bearing on which group they went in. In fact, they statistically staggered them, so you had morons in both categories. I shouldn't talk so badly about what are probably very sweet, you know, little children belonging to other loving parents. But they were morons if they got an 80 on their IQ test, because that's how we define moron. Then they gave them a second test. Both groups were given a choice between a harder test described as more challenging and a similar test that was described as being easy. The majority of the kids who were told, you must be smart, chose the easy test. 90% of the kids who were told, you worked hard, chose the harder test. What's our conclusion? If you tell children they are smart, they will take the cop-out path. When I read this study, I did not read the study thinking, this is a presentation that I can give to people who want to become science fiction writers or who have lesser aspirations, like, you know, web cartooning or something like that. I'm so sorry. she just told me she started the second webcomic, and I'm trying to call her repentance, but I shouldn't be doing it publicly. When I read this, that was not my first thought. My first thought was, I am going to stop telling my children they're smart. I'm serious. I'm done telling my kids they're smart, and I'm going to start telling them, good job, you worked hard on this. You kicked ass, buddy. Only I don't say that to my 10-year-old. I say that to my 14-year-old, but I don't say it to my 10-year-old. All right, now they gave them a third test, and this test was hard. Okay, it was two grade levels higher than the test subjects. The you must be smart kids languished and acted depressed. They assumed they weren't smart after all, and the majority of them gave up before the test was even done. You must be smart. And then they're handed something that's tough, and they decide, oh, you lied to me, I'm not smart. The you must have worked hard kids focused, got interested, and some of them remarked, this was my favorite test. All right, now think about yourself for a second. Which category do you want to be in? You want to be the sort of person who looks at something difficult and says, I like this. This is hard. And rolls up your sleeves and goes to work. That's who you want to be. That's who we want our children to be. That's who, if you're going to succeed in this life, you really have to be. I say succeed, I mean excel. Obviously, it's possible to succeed without being excellent, as I've already demonstrated. Then they gave him a final test. Final test. Essentially the same as the first one. You must be smart. They performed 20% worse than they did the first time. These kids have been demoralized. They've become convinced that they weren't smart, and they just petered out. The you must have worked hard performed 30% better than they did the first time. Now understand, the kids were not given training on retaking this test as the fourth test. Their attitude towards the test changed. Their attitude towards their schoolwork changed. And if their grades went up, or if their scores went up, it went up because of things that they started doing on their own. So what did we just learn? Okay, the obvious. Praise your children for their efforts, not for their abilities. Second, believing that a task requires innate ability or talent provokes failure. Believing that that same task instead requires hard work provokes success. The difference, you can control how hard you work, but you can't control how talented you are. You can't control your innate ability. If you believe you're in control of whether you succeed or fail, you are more likely to succeed. Now, I'm not a motivational speaker. A motivational speaker will get up here and tell you, if you believe you can do it, and if it depends on you, then you can do it. Go! No. What I'm saying is, if you believe you can do it, if you believe that it rides on you, then you are statistically more likely to succeed at it. There is a difference between those two statements, because some of you will try and will fail, and then will fail to try again. And I don't want that to happen, and I don't want it to be my fault. So there's the disclaimer.
I always find motivational posters depressing anyway.
Yeah. I don't like motivational posters. Hard work. It takes time. Brandon Sanderson's on this slide twice, and he's sitting in the back of the room. I feel wave to us, Brandon.
Hi.
Okay. If I get any of these facts wrong, Brandon will set us straight. Henry Miller. Near as I can tell, he's the guy who originated this quote. You've got to write 1,000,000 words, perhaps more, before you get down your first true word. He said that, I think, in 66, 67, somewhere in there. Might have been the 50s, though. David Gerrold said, your first 1,000,000 words are for practice. They don't count. David Gerrold then went on to say, if you get paid for some of your first 1,000,000 words, go ahead and start practicing cashing the checks. We hear that a lot as writers. It's a funny joke. You know, your first 1,000,000 words of practice, but if you can get paid for some of them, don't turn the money down. Elantris, how do I say this?
However you want.
Okay.
I say it both ways.
Schmunkabunga.
Economics.
Elantris was not Brandon's first novel. Elantris was Brandon's sixth novel. It was the first to get published. Mistborn, which was Brandon's second published novel, was the 14th that he'd written. All right, how many of you, show of hands, go ahead and embarrass yourselves, how many of you are working right now on your first novel? Awesome. Fantastic. I have just told you that it's probably not going to be the first one that gets published. That might be depressing for you. I don't want it to be. I want you to know that some of the very most successful people that I know, that I've ever met, have never had their first novel published. I am a horrible, horrible exception to this rule in that the first thing that I ever set out to create in terms of science fiction illustrated goodness was Schlock Mercenary, and it actually made me a living. That is statistically anomalous and weird, and it's the reason why I can get away with not being artistically excellent, but we'll come back to that. Is innate ability important? There's got to be something to talent. Whether you're Mormon or, you know, just Judeo-Christian or whatever, we talk a lot about, you know, the gifts that God has given us. Certainly there's something to talent, isn't there? Well, of course. But can you identify innate ability? Can you look at a 10-year-old child and say, you're going to be a fantastic neurosurgeon? You can't do that. More importantly, you can't look at a 10-year-old child and say, kid, you do not have a future as a doctor. You can't. You flat out can't. We do not have the metric. We do not have any sort of testable metric that will let you confidently make that prediction among people who happen to not be morons. I'm going to assume that we're talking about baseline intelligence, not people who are statistically, you know, off the chart, dumb, you know, just broken people. We're not talking about handicapped people. We're talking about normal. Okay, so some of us are science fiction fans, so we might consider that a handicap. But let's talk about your birthday. Let's talk about innate ability in a statistical study on soccer players. Now, if any of you have read, I haven't, but if you've read Outliers, he cites this study. The Freakonomics guys cite this study. There's a lot of people who have cited this exact study because it's so weird. Age group cutoff for youth is in August. We're talking about youth soccer, and the age group cutoff is in August. August birthday boys had a very slight statistical size advantage and maturity advantage for their age group. I mean, if you're starting soccer at age 8, and you're 8 years and 11 months old, and you're standing next to a kid who's 8 years and 2 months old, there might be some differences in height. Okay, it's slight. But the coaches focus their training on the bigger kids. If a kid just has to be a tiny bit bigger, he says, you there, I want you as a forward because you're intimidating. Intimidating? He's 11 months older than the other kids. It's not really that significant. But he gets the training. The result is that that training advantage stacks over time. And so we see this amazing curve in which the youth soccer players who are, this was World Cup youth soccer, by the time they're 18, 19 years old, and they're competing with other 18, 19 year olds, all right, how much size advantage do you have if you're 18 and 11 months versus somebody who's 18 and 1 month? None. It has nothing to do with your age, it has everything to do with genetics, okay, and just how big or robust you are genetically. And that genetic advantage, whatever that genetic advantage is, comes out in the wash compared to training. What matters here is the training that these kids got from their coaches. And it's significant. If you want to play soccer, you need to be recognized by the coach as a little bit bigger and a little bit more promising so that you get the training. Or, better yet, you need to decide that the fact that you're the youngest kid on the team, you want to be one of these kids down here who actually shows up in the May-July graph, not one of the kids who dropped out and isn't present at age 19. Does that make sense? I beat that horse into the ground. Conclusion. If there is an innate ability factor to be found in youth soccer, it is statistically insignificant compared to training. Yes, this same principle has been shown repeatedly across multiple disciplines. Now, you would expect that in sports, of all things, you'd be able to point at a child and say, you have outwardly visible physical characteristics that are representative of somebody who is going to be a fantastic soccer player. And the fact of the matter is, your birthday is more important because of the training you're going to get from the coach. If you can't identify innate ability that way, how can you identify it for neurosurgeons and fantasy writers? Great quote here from a study about practice. The search for stable, heritable characteristics that could predict or at least account for superior performance of eminent individuals has been surprisingly unsuccessful. Translation. Science is having a hard time finding this talent thing. Same guys. Much longer quote. I'm going to read it from a piece of paper so that I can actually face you. The belief that the striking differences between expert performers and less accomplished performers reflect innate abilities, talent, is so strong that the failure to identify the specific talents necessary for expert performance in a given domain is viewed at most as a temporary problem until the relevant talents are discovered. The conviction in the importance of talent appears to be based on the insufficiencies of alternative hypotheses to explain the exceptional nature of expert performance. All right, let's translate that. Everybody keeps believing talent is critical for superior performance, despite the fact that science can't identify talent. Why do we do that? We're doing it because we lack a better explanation. We keep believing in talent, even though we can't see it, because we don't have any other explanation that works for us. So these guys put together, when I say these guys, I'm talking about, back up, Erickson, Cramp, and Tesh Romer put together a study. in which they looked at this, tried to come up with an alternative hypothesis. They've got a book out, which I really need to read because it probably renders my presentation outdated. Practice and experience lead to maximal performance, not talent. Practice and experience. Some kinds of practice are better than others. Work, job-related work, is not the same as practice. And deliberate, focused practice is better than simple, rote practice and much, much better than work. In short, practice makes perfect. That thing your mom has been telling you since her grandma told it to her and was told it by her grandma. Practice makes perfect is the honest truth. Here's a little bit of supporting evidence. In chess, it is statistically rare to attain international chess master status after less than 10 years of intense preparation. I think Bobby Fischer did it in like 9.5. So you could argue, well, yeah, he was talented, but he didn't shave a whole lot off of that enormous amount of time that had to be spent practicing.
I think there's a kid that's been playing for less than 10 years that hit it, but she's also exceptional.
I'm not familiar with that, but the study that I got this from is
15
years old, so if she hasn't been playing for 10 years, she probably hadn't been born when they did the math.
Right.
In music and composition, 10 years of experience appears to be the minimum required before the first outstanding pieces are composed. Mozart wrote his first piece at age 4, and it was the musical equivalent of refrigerator art. Okay, hey, look at that, my son can hold a crayon. Hey, look at that, my kid is surrounded by music all day and is hearing good music, and I've handed him a pen and paper, and he wrote an opera. And, okay, it's like a 3-minute opera. But, okay, I'm not saying Mozart wasn't talented. I'm saying that his really good stuff appeared about 10 years after he started writing. For scientists, authors, and poets, you like how we get grouped? Authors? Any authors in the room? Author? Okay, any scientists in the room? Couples? Okay, fantastic. We're among greatness. Poets? All right, there's a couple of poets. I like how they group these people all in the same category, because we're all thinking. The average time between first publication and publication of their greatest work is just over 10 years. 10 years. It keeps coming back to 10 years. Now let's talk about spending that decade. Work is reward-based. Good enough gets the reward. If you think about it, you're collecting a paycheck. Once you start collecting a paycheck, you generally stop getting much better at what it is you're doing. Why? Because when you're working, you avoid doing what you're worst at. If there's a way for you to collect your paycheck without doing the hard stuff, you'll do it. And that's part of what's wrong with the American auto industry and the National Cartoonist Society and any other number of organizations out there that wants to be able to maintain some sort of status quo. And I find it in my own work. I looked at my comics and realized, man, I've learned to frame these panels so I don't have to draw hands. You know, the captain stands at parade rest a lot, and if he needs to gesture, it looks like crap. And he'll often keep one hand behind his back because I didn't know what to do with this other hand. Drawing hands was hard, and I was able to collect a paycheck without drawing hands. So, why draw hands? Practice is goal-based. Practice is where you focus on your weaknesses and you turn your weaknesses into strengths. All right, I mentioned religion a little bit when we talked about talent. Let's mention religion again, and I will make your weaknesses into strengths. That's cool. Wow. Sounds almost like, you know, God's on both sides of the argument, which is handy for him. rewards for practicing are greatly delayed. Practicing drawing hands for me did not result in massive new sales of Schlock Mercenary books. It's just something I did because I was tired of people, you know, walking around with their hands in their pockets. So, spending that decade, I hit the space bar and nothing happened. Ascent, arrival, and ascent. I don't have a laser pointer. One, the one there, year at which practice was initiated. So that little tiny line down at the bottom, we can call that little tiny line innate ability. The performance or whatever of this person who has never really been introduced to this and is practicing it. Okay, that's just raw. And then they start practicing, and in zone two there, it jumps up until they get employed. And then we see another little blip upward because they got employed and probably their boss said, you know what, congratulations on learning C++, but you should have been studying C#. And in fact, this year we're all transitioning to C#. And I don't know the first thing about programming, I'm just making this stuff up. This applies to authors and to programmers and to engineers and technicians and all kinds of other things. When you enter the workplace, the people who are signing your paychecks often want you to do stuff that you're not yet doing, that your practice didn't prepare you for. And so you end up practicing at work, and that's that third curve. And then it levels off and plateaus for infinity, and that is your destiny, right? Can you get better than that?
Only if you want to.
Only if you want to. Let's talk about that plateau effect. You've worked at this for years, and you realize you're really not getting any better at it. Is it because you suck? Is it because you have no talent? Have any of you ever had a teacher who told you to your face, you really don't have any talent for this? Have you ever had a teacher who did that? I asked this question at university, and every hand went up.
Only one ever did it to me was a driving instructor.
Okay, and but still, that's something that can be practiced.
It's
not something
years.
I want you practicing while I'm on the road. Still, it's something you can learn. So you've practiced this for a long time now, and it's just not improving. You feel like you're stagnating. Do any of you feel this way? You look at your own work and feel like, I'm just not progressing. What am I doing wrong? I thought practice makes perfect. Howard Taylor told me that practice makes perfect, and I'm not perfect. And I've been practicing for 20 years. And some of you have been. Why is it not working? Well, first of all, it happens to everybody. You saw the graph, so don't panic. Work is not the same as practice. It's possible that you've been dodging the hard bits. Practice won't help if you're not practicing the right things in the right way. And this is where you could spend 500 pages per discipline talking to people about what it is they should be practicing. And I'm not prepared to give you, 20,000 pages of discourse on the various fields that you're engaged in. At least you've noticed the stagnation. Good. If you figured out that you've plateaued, fantastic. Now you can do something about it. What are you going to do about it? First, talk to an expert and then listen. Okay, there are people at this convention who qualify as experts. I'm going to point out a couple of them really quick, and they're going to be really embarrassed. Dan Willis is a really good writer who has helped me with three-act format. And I handed him, I have Dan and Bob, Bob Defendi, who, is Bob coming? Okay, I haven't seen Bob. Once you've seen Bob, you never forget Bob. I had Dan and Bob come over to my house for 6 hours one Saturday, and I handed them a Schlock Mercenary storyline that was two-thirds complete. And I said, please identify the promises that I've made to my readers so that I can resolve them all in the third act, because you guys know this better than I do. And they took extensive notes, and I learned more in that 6 hours on writing than I learned in months and months and months of just studying it on my own. Talk to an expert and then listen. Second expert is Stacy Whitman, who's a fantastic editor. Stacy, you've edited bazillions of children's books, and I don't know what your CV looks like. And she, I hired her to edit Extreme Dungeon Mastery by Tracy Hickman. Now, Tracy Hickman, he's got, 50 books in print? In print right now? Tracy, did his writing need a little bit of editing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm not an editor, and I could tell that it needed editing, all right? Tracy would have benefited from sitting down with you while you were editing and listening to the expert and then perhaps practicing the bits, tightening up his writing. But that's the sort of thing we can all benefit from. If you feel like you're stagnating, talk to an expert. Find out what's wrong with what you're doing, and then get advice on how to practice more effectively. Tackle something hard. Tracy mentioned XDM, Extreme Dungeon Mastery by Tracy Hickman. He wanted me to illustrate a role-playing book for him. I'd never illustrated a role-playing book, so I thought, sure, I can do this. I find, oh, sign the contract, and then his son Curtis, who is a magician, prestidigitator, says, by the way, some of the things in the book involve, card tricks and contact juggling and things like that. I need you to draw technical diagrams of my hands. You need a what? You don't want to draw hands. Can't you do the trick like this? Fortunately, just before that happened, I had decided, probably ought to work on hands. And so I had the barest inkling of what needed to be done when he handed me this stuff. And then I told him, from your description, I've got no idea what this hand is supposed to look like. So he took photos of his hands. I thought, this is easy. I'll just draw the hands. Boy, those are washed out. I can't tell where your knuckles are. So it was a mixture of what I ended up doing is light boxing the photos. That's artist speak for tracing. Traced the photographs and then pushed the photograph away and looked at what was kind of a, drew turkeys in grade school. I looked at these turkeys and thought, okay, where do the feathers go? And drew knuckles and fingernails and shading and things like that. And I got to the point where I looked at these card trick illustrations that I'd done and realized these illustrations are better illustrated than some of the card tricks that I paid money for as a kid. Wow, that's awesome. And you know why? It's because most of the card tricks that I bought as a kid were illustrated because somebody took a picture of their hand that was washed out and awful because they couldn't afford to hire a person. Finally, don't be afraid to reinvent your game. I think I heard that Tiger Woods had decided that his short game just wasn't good enough. And he was going back to basics and relearning how to putt. Hello, you're Tiger Woods. You need to relearn how to putt. Well, he's not winning as many championships as he wants to. He's still winning. He's just not winning as many as he wants to. And so a guy who is ostensibly not at the top of his game, at the top of the game, at the top of his field, decides he wants to be better. And so he steps out and gets better. We all plateau. We all suffer from that long stretch of I haven't improved. We can all break out of it. My advice for creative people. This is not stuff that was in that scientific study. Don't bother looking for something you think you're good at. It'll just make you lazy. Don't even bother. I have heard so many people tell me, I would love to draw a webcomic, but I can't draw. All right. Did you see that first picture of Schlock that I put up there? I would have loved to draw a webcomic without first learning how to draw, but that wasn't an option, and it isn't an option for anybody. If it's something that you think you would love to do, pick up your skirts, gird up your loins, whatever the metaphor is supposed to be, put on your shoes and go do it. Pick something you have a passion for. Do what you've always wanted to do. Work, practice, and perform with that passion. It is possible that innate ability is nothing more than passion. I don't have proof for that. I can't quantify that statement with scientific evidence, but I haven't met anybody who was an expert in their field who was not also passionate about what they were doing. If there is such a thing as talent, then the odds are pretty good that you'll pick something you have a talent for. If there's no such thing as talent, then it doesn't matter. Right? So pick something you love. And finally, forget the science, and just rejoice when people start insulting your years of hard work by saying, you are so talented. Final quote. The dynamic range of raw human ability is tiny compared to the range of practiced human accomplishment. And that's me. Any questions? Yes, sir. Peter.
Can you download this presentation?
I can make it available for you, yes, and I have a bibliography. So, would you like me to send it to you, Peter?
Yes. Yeah,
okay. Yes, sir.
Can we go back and see that first picture of the Schlock comic?
It makes my eyes bleed. Yes, we can go back and see.
A lot of people that don't have their first novel published have since decided to suggest as well.
Yes, I can go. Did you want me to page back to that picture for you?
Yeah, I missed it at the
beginning. Oh, I'm sorry. How many times do I have to push backspace?
Many.
There you go.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Did you have any formal training in drawing or, before you started?
I took one college class in drawing. It wasn't a figure drawing class. It was just, we just penciled shapes and things. I wanted to see if it was something that I would like, and I discovered that it was something that looked hard, and so I decided not to do it. Understand, my college career, I really wish I had known then what I know now. My college career was a disaster because I started out as a chemical engineer, and I looked at the people who were coming back and lecturing to us who were former Brigham University chemical engineers, and I thought, every last one of these guys is a dumpy bald guy. I do not want to end up a dumpy bald guy. I am not making this up. Those were the words that came out of this mouth. And so I thought, I'm going to go into something cool. And so I went into music. And then our very first guest lecturer came in, and he was a dumpy bald guy. And I thought, oh, I get it. The people who come back to the school lecture are cool. It's the ones who actually stay in the field who are cool. And here I am lecturing, and I'm a dumpy bald guy. So I went into music because I thought music is something I love. I took the penciling class because I thought maybe I have talent for penciling. Maybe this will be easy. And what I discovered is this is long. He is making me crosshatch, like, forever. It takes forever to fill this with pencil strokes. And if I don't do them all exactly the same way, then it looks wrong. And if I erase, it changes the surface texture of the paper, and my instructor can tell that, and he gets all pissed at me. This is awful. I hate this. And so I took one class and was done. And that was in 1986. Yes?
How do you deal with fear, and do you deal with fear?
Oh, wow. How do I deal with fear? I'm terrified all the time. I am an introvert. This experience right here is fundamentally frightening. I'm good at it. And I'm good at it because I've had other people tell me what I need to do in order to get good at it. And I've kind of worked around my insecurities. And I do it now because it's a little bit like riding a roller coaster or eating a squirrel. Woo! It's fun to be afraid. That help at all? Sometimes, yeah, it's thrilling. That's why we go to horror movies. We
if you're in people. Control.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's fair. That's what kind of fear? What are you afraid of? Don't be afraid of success. Okay, if you're afraid of not being good enough. I don't think you're afraid of not being good enough. I think you're afraid, this is me psychoanalyzing you now, because that is what you paid for. It is possible that you're not afraid of not being good enough. You're afraid of somebody else telling you that you're not good enough. Or that you're afraid of going out on a limb and investing something and trying to be good enough and not being good enough and failing in such a way that you've lost time or money or something else. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that one.
Okay, that one. Are you enjoying what you're doing? Are you enjoying the investment of time and money and whatever else?
Oh, but I haven't started doing the thing that I'm afraid of yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's why I'm not doing it, because I'm afraid.
Okay.
Fuck it up.
I'm sorry, this analysis could go on for some time because it's fascinating and...
Am I the one who's afraid of it?
Is anybody here afraid of failing?
I'm afraid of it.
Good! You're afraid of failing. Fantastic.
That's why I address
Don't let that days. Stop you from trying. Please.
No, it's not failing.
Because you...
But, yeah.
I had it on the slide somewhere. Didn't I fail often?
Yeah.
Was on there? Please! Fail often.
I know, I read that. I really don't like
failing. Neither do I. Seriously. I get email from time to time where people say, especially right now, I'm messing around with the backgrounds in the comic strip. I'm messing around with the backgrounds in the comic, where I've decided I'm going to start drawing them with markers. Okay? And it's a neat stylistic thing that I've started to do. And I think it looks cool. And every so often somebody will email me and say, boy, today's background just looks like crap. All right, that qualifies as failure. All right, especially since I did the background and I looked at it and thought, oh, maybe it'll look better after I apply Gaussian blur and it's got other art in front of it. And then I look at it in the finished product and I think, well, I don't have enough time to go back and fix it, but it's probably good enough for the audience. And then somebody calls me on it. That's failure on like three or four levels. I knew it wasn't good enough, and I put it out there anyway. And I learned from it. I say, all right, so they didn't like that one. Okay, so I need to not do it that way again. I have to be careful because my work is very public and very, there's a feedback loop attached to it. And I can't let certain elements of that feedback loop stop me from continuing to work. I can't, because there are people who will say, boy, this story has lost me, I'm done. I'm not reading your comic anymore. That is not an invitation for me to say, oh, well, I should just give up on this story. Okay, everybody, 40,000 readers, I'm going to stop telling this story and start telling a different one because somebody didn't like it. I don't take that kind of criticism to heart. But if somebody criticizes the art in a way that I recognize I also got wrong, I try to fix it. Yes?
I was thinking back to a media student I had once who had no fear. And at first I envied him. I thought, that'd be cool if I didn't have a fear. But then when he did his recitals, I realized he hadn't gotten any better over several years. And
because he made mistakes and not care.
Yeah. For me, that fear of failure has been a big motivator to improve myself not only as a musician, but as a writer as well.
Right. And there's a level to it that you've got to be careful with, because there's fear of failure that makes you want to be better, and then there's fear of failure that paralyzes you and prevents you from doing anything. If that's what you're suffering from, I'm not sure if I can help, because I don't have that. Because that's I was going to use the word neurosis. I've got different neuroses, and we won't go into those. Yes, sir.
I'm starting to venture here at Con, and the risk is such that I might not be able to pay rent this next month. And it's kind of like, the risk is like being on a high dive if you're scared of heights. And you don't want to climb back down the ladder, you just got to jump. And whatever happens, it might hurt if you hit the water.
Roller coaster, woo! This is fun! Oh, that's going to hurt! Yeah.
You start taking the risk and jump.
When I ate squirrel, I found the hair in it, and that's the point at which I was done. But I'm so glad I did it. I'm so glad I did it, because now I know never to eat that again.
We learned.
Other questions. How are we doing on time? We got 10 minutes before I have to wrap up. Yes, sir.
Just a question. How do you recognize your weaknesses? I mean, what if you have a weakness, but it's like the Emperor's New Clothes, and you don't have them? I mean, you don't know what it is.
How do you recognize your weaknesses? The answer is, where was it?
Talk to an expert and listen.
Yes. Talk to an expert and listen. The odds are good that you're not going to recognize your weakness. The odds are good that you're going to look at the things that you think are your strengths, and look at some of them and say, I'm actually not very good at that. And keep practicing what you're already good at. Your actual weaknesses may be complete blind spots for you. I don't know what it is you're trying to work on, so I don't know where the expert
is. Well, how do you personally do it?
How do I personally do it? I talk to artists. I go, my writing. Let's talk about my writing, because that's where I'm surrounded by experts. Brandon Sanderson is an English major. Dan Wells is an English major. Dan Willis, I don't know what you studied, but you got good at writing. Bob Defendi, Writers of the Future winner. These guys are friends of mine by virtue of the fact that I created a webcomic that made them laugh, and they let me into their exclusive little club of people who know how to write. And then I paid very, very close attention to every word that came out of their mouths when they were talking about writing. I've actually grown enough that I can disagree with Brandon and feel confident in my disagreement. He told me, and I'm burying my soul here, he told me, you know what? I think that your requirement that Schlock Mercenary have a punchline every day, I think that's a weakness. I think you need to give up on the daily punchlines every so often, because it always ends on an up note. It never lets you have real tragedy in the comic. And I told Brandon, yeah, I've been worried about that for a long time, but this is now a commercial endeavor that succeeds on the strength of people tuning in every day to laugh. And if they stop laughing, I've done something wrong. And so Brandon and I had to agree to disagree, where I was agreeing that the strip could maybe be better, but if it got better, it would stop being what it was, and it needed to keep being what it was in order to be financially viable. And I don't want to take that risk. If I want to write something that doesn't have punchlines in it, or that has real dark moments in it, I'll write fiction so I don't have to draw pictures. But yeah, surround yourself with experts. This is a great place to meet those people, which is one of the reasons why I introduced Stacy and Dan, who are probably just a couple of the people in the room who are capable of functioning as experts in some domain or another. If you get the chance to talk to these people, if you hear a conversation happening in the halls that sounds interesting to you and sounds educational, listen, contribute, talk, learn. It's fun and frightening. And sometimes, you know, you meet somebody who turns out to be a jerk. I'm reminded of Will Wheaton talking about William Shatner. But, I can't tell that story without dropping the F-bomb. Another question. I got 5 minutes. Oh, yes, ma'am.
I had a question. The transition from being, you know, how do you know, going into the webcomic, how did you and your wife handle that? I mean, that had to be pretty hard, right?
Okay, question. How did I handle the transition moving from full-time employment with a secure, theoretically, employer in the software business, Novell, who's laid off more people in Utah County than anybody except Geneva Steele.
Who had more to begin with.
Yeah, who had 8,000 employees to begin with. How did I make that transition? I didn't do it with science. I didn't do it with math. I didn't do it with accounting. I didn't do it with any of the stuff that you see up here. I did it with a whole lot of prayer. Sandra and I prayed about it and realized it is time to leave Novell, and we're not entirely sure why, but it's time to leave. And so we left, and we made what was financially the worst decision anybody could make. No accountant or counselor would make this decision. I voluntarily quit. I got no severance package. And I went from a six-figure salary, okay, low six figures, like $800 more than the minimum required to call it six figures. Still, there were six figures. I went from a low six-figure salary to a negative three-figure salary. Okay, yes, I've lost $600 so far that year on cartooning, according to the books. That is not a business plan. That is a leap of faith. And that's exactly what we did. We made a leap of faith, and we were rewarded for it. But I can't promise that your leap of faith will be similarly rewarded, because that's not how it works. I found that the real reward for me leaving Novell was not getting to be a cartoonist. The real reward was discovering that I had been neglecting my family for 5 years, and I needed to reconnect with them. And that's 5 years that I'm not going to get back. But I'm trying to make up lost time. And the transition, Sandra and I have a panel next where we talk about some of that stuff, but it was 15 months of harrowing anxiety and incredible fear of failure, all the time, fear of failure, and looking at what we've done and saying, have we failed yet? Is this failure? No, let's throw more money at it and see if that's really failure. And finally, we got to the point 13 months in. It was 2 months before, we were going to run out of money, where where we took the last of the money that we had and printed 5,000 copies of this. And I mean, that's betting the farm. That was, you know what, if this doesn't sell, I'm done being a cartoonist. I sold 1,800 copies on the web in 30 days, paid the bills for 6 months, and realized, oh, now all I need to do is this in 6 months and I'll be okay. And that's the way the business went. So it was fun, it was terrifying. I still live in fear of failure. I mean, I look at the economic indicators and I say, oh gosh, what happens if my, you know, 2,000 true fans who are buying these books, you know, what if they're all fired? I mean, seriously, it's only 2,000 people. GM laid off, you know, 10 times that many people, like last month or something. Apparently General Motors workers don't read science fiction webcomics, but anyway, I'm digressing. It was frightening, and it was fun, and it was exhilarating, and it's the best thing I've ever done in my life, and I can't recommend it in good conscience to anybody, because I don't know if it's for you. Does that make sense? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm out of time. Thank you so much for your time.